Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 311 featuring Robert Dernan, who's someone who I worked with at Digital Domain for a while. And he's also done, but he was a TD at Digital Domain, but he's done a bunch of other development, done a bunch of XR stuff and a bunch of interesting things. He worked at Magnopus for a while. He's been kind of a little bit everywhere, right, Kristen?
Yeah, it's like... I said he's like very adventurous, like cause he's been all over the place, kind of like a perpetual learner. He kind of talks about that at the end too. Like he really learns each thing he goes to. He doesn't do anything halfway. So
No. Yeah, he takes it fully. Like I'm going to learn all about that one thing, and then he'll learn. Yep, yeah, absolutely. You nailed it. And what's you said he's very adventurous. Like he's willing to move and go all over the place. And after we finished recording, he goes, "Oh, I forgot to tell you this story." But basically, he went on vacation somewhere in South America. Or it may have been Central America. I don't remember exactly, but right before the pandemic, and he got stuck there for like a couple of months because he couldn't fly back right as the pandemic hit, which is really kind of amazing. Like in trying to work out of a resort. I don't know all the details, but it was quite amazing. So yeah, he's a pretty cool guy. I really like Robert. He does a lot of really cool stuff. We talk about obviously a lot of the stuff that he got into being a TD and what that means about developing tools, which I think is something very interesting to learn about what it means to develop tools and to work with companies to develop tools. He's done a bunch of stuff at the XR and AR world. He sort of started a company as well, and then he worked at Magnopus as well. Mm-hmm. So all of those really, really cool things that are going on. So I like this podcast. I thought it was great. Robert was very, very interesting. I think there's a lot to be learned about what it takes to be a developer in today, what that can be. So really cool stuff. Great. We have just a few announcements this week. Yep. Not as much because a lot of things have sort of ended, but going on, what's happening?
So you can find these out at chaosgroup.com. As we have talked about, Vantage is out, and so is V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D. And also we have V-Ray 5 for Revit beta available.
Right. Right, V-Ray 5, as you guys know, is rolling out all over the place. We're going to have some big stuff going on in a few weeks for V-Ray 5 across the board, so we're excited about that. But for V-Ray 5 for Revit, obviously people have been wanting to know about V-Ray 5 for Revit, and it's in beta now, so please go check it out. We'd love to get your feedback. Obviously, V-Ray 5 for C4D has been much anticipated as well, so if you guys are interested in that, it's available also on our website. Vantage, by the time this podcast comes out, I believe that the Building Utopia competition will be over, but I really look forward to finding out what people are able to do with Vantage. Vantage is our real-time ray tracer standalone package that's fully ray traced, fully real-time, and really curious to see what cool stuff people do with Vantage, and if they use it to their advantage. I love that joke.
Ooh, so good.
It's a stupid joke. No, it's stupid. Don't laugh at that, Kristen. Don't laugh at us. Don't encourage that behavior. Okay. Great. So if people, obviously, as Kristen said, all of this information is available at chaosgroup.com, and go ahead and check it out. If people want to know more about the podcast, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have ideas for podcasts, guests, or any feedback whatsoever, let us know. labs@chaosgroup.com. We'd love to let you know. Love to hear from you and know what you guys want to hear. Also, as you guys know, we are doing videos of all of these podcasts. So those are also available on our Facebook page. And you can see us in video form. I'm experimenting with some new higher-end video cameras for our podcast. I was like, well, we've been doing this for almost a year now, Kristen. Almost a year.
All the videos too. I went back and looked the other day. I was like, oh, whoa.
Yeah. I had even more hair back then, but not that I have much left. But anyway, so that's also available. And of course, on our YouTube channel, it is Chaos Group TV. And we put all of our podcasts up on Chaos Group TV, which is available on YouTube. All right, that being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Robert Dernan.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm a bit tired. I've been doing a lot of interviewing early in the morning with people overseas, and it's meant a lot of sitting up, getting ready for things, and then being up at 6 and 7 in the morning to talk to them. It's kind of burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Why are you in? What are you interviewing? What's going on?
Well, I mean, I got the early start of my career in the EU, and I have an Irish passport, which is kind of something I've been meaning to resurrect and go back to go and look for work. Now, I left LA at the end of August.
Okay.
And I've been kind of planning to go back to either Berlin or to Barcelona for work, depending on a couple of things, you know.
Right. But you went back to Vancouver or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. And that's where you're from, right?
I'm originally from Vancouver.
You're originally from Vancouver. All right. Well, let's give people a little bit of history, because you and I have actually worked together. And you and I worked together on Tron, which is where I think we first met. And we did a lot of some interesting work back then. We were part of the transition team of V-Ray at that point.
Yeah, we got to do a lot of really deep debugging on V-Ray.
Yeah.
And I think that it gave me a much more solid set of fundamentals in rendering.
Right.
Which was thanks to the team that we were working with more than my own efforts, really.
So. Yeah, it was interesting because we basically, there was a lot of things we were trying to do in V-Ray, and we were having, you know, trying to get it fixed. Vlado was very good at trying to make sure that he could support it as much as possible. In fact, I remember very specifically, there was one very weird bug that was extremely hard to reproduce that we had, that had these little black speckles on reflections. And it was like, we couldn't figure out when it happened, what happened. And then the only way we could actually get it fixed is when Vlado sat down at the office, started coding on the shot itself. And I think you were helping him figure out okay, this is all I figured out. And then he finally got it.
He just picked it up like it was really not that heavy and walked all the way out of the room carrying it. It's one of those moments that you're kind of excited by and a little bit embarrassed by as well. Here I was grunting at how heavy this task was.
Actually remember him being like, got it. Like he was like kind of excited a little bit, but Vlado doesn't really show that much emotion. So that's...
I see.
But he did have a little bit of pride about doing that. That was fun. But okay, so you said that was sort of your when you started to really get into rendering or doing some interesting deep dives into that field, which was interesting too. But let's take a little back. Let's go a little further back than that. What got you interested in computer graphics? What got you interested in the visual effects industry? How did that all start?
Well, I worked, Vancouver had a big film community.
Yeah.
And when I was in my 1920, one of my roommates was in the camera department.
Okay.
Doing a big IATSE training thing. And probably at that time, there was a lot of artists and sort of skateboard types that funneled their way to the film industry and took these kind of insanely houred, high paying gig jobs. And I was aiming to work as a set electric, kind of with the intention of going out on the set and seeing what I could do as far as practical effects went, because that was, that seemed like fun.
Right.
And so I actually got a job at a production services company, which is, one of the ones that lends out all of the equipment to film sets. And I spent some time doing lighting on independent film projects. So during the daytime, I was coiling cable And during the weekends, I was plugging away, you know, lifting things or tying together cables for film sets.
Wow.
And one of my friends came to me and said that the animation program that he was involved in had a visual effects component or a visual effects program that they would be offering in one of the next semesters. And I took a look into it and joined them in 1999.
Okay.
So I took a course that was soft image Maya and introduced kind of the Hypershade graph editor and a lot of the soft body dynamics and sort of basic particle dynamics of Maya that were just being, just starting to really grow shape in film projects.
But so you were self-taught then mostly on this stuff then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of lessons that have come from getting the opportunity to sit in the room with smart people.
Sure.
You know, but when I, you know, school, I took some courses that were part of a bigger program, but I thought that I would gain more traction kind of completing it on my own. And on high-end 3D, which was the go-to resource at the time.
Yeah, I remember.
there was positions that were very clear in their expectations of what people should have skills-wise.
Right.
You know? So, you know, they were asking shader writers, which is kind of what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and to have a skill set that included C-shell bash from Linux, and then the RenderMan shading language, and some understanding of Perl and C.
Right.
And those were not part of the course that I took at all.
Yeah.
So I pivoted a little bit, and I took to learning that stuff on my own at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. I mean, I remember, yeah. And some of those are, you know, not used as much today. Like people don't use Perl as much, and then people have to start using Python and other things. I remember that big switch was like, we're going to try a new scripting language called Python.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Like I remember when the first, you know, there was a way to wrap C in sort of a meta programming language that would compile out Python objects called Swig.
Okay.
And somebody had figured out how to Swig the Maya API so that you could make calls into Maya. And it coincided with an IT boss that I had who told me that I wasn't allowed to use Perl. You know?
Okay.
He was quite strong-willed, and he didn't want to deal with Perl because Perl required a secondary installation, whereas on Linux machines, Python was already native because it was part of the setup program in order to run the installer.
Right.
So it was kind of, it was his call, and I was green enough that I just took his word as law.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. So you really got into to doing that. And I remember, you know, when we were working on Tron, you really got into the shading stuff and the technical issues and debugging and all those different things in that area. So what were some of the projects that you worked on to that were sort of doing that? Because I guess you were much more of a TD, right? You were on show TD that's really what I knew you as at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's been really helpful to me throughout my career to be able to build my own prototypes. You know, yeah. A lot of the time, for the sake of a proof of concept, it's not enough to just explain to somebody that something can be done. And, you know, sometimes getting something like Massive to communicate with Mental Ray and to produce render frames would require you to do a whole setup and configuration of a machine, some changes to the networking, and to script out all of these repeated efforts that you need to sort of iterate. So I also kind of made a habit of sort of trading what I did know already to people in exchange for opportunities to work on things that were maybe more interesting, you know?
Okay.
So while I was petitioning people to write shaders, I earned the responsibility of managing their render farms, which meant, you know, walking through output logs from the renderer and then stepping through functions and figuring out why, you know, similar to the problem you just described with Vlado, why you're getting these anomaly behaviors when certain things are combined with others.
Right. That's actually a really good way, like managing a render farm is actually a really good way to learn lighting because you get to see everything and find out what's working and what's not working. Why is it rendering? Why is a rendering taking too long or why it's not, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when people were able to work with RenderMan, it had a lot of features that were part of the renderer that made these like larger pipelines much easier. You know, you could fire a text stream at the open renderer and modify the text stream as it was being sent. So you could do things like replace a cube with an entire city.
Right.
Whereas on the ray tracing side, at least with Mental Ray years ago, you needed kind of an upfront footprint of everything that was going to be rendered in the scene so it could start building a tree of all of the rays that would be cast for different purposes.
Right.
So there's like, you know, you're bringing a tool into an environment where people already have a fully functioning set of workflows and tools. And in order to replace even a small part of that, you need to be able to give them back something that works as well as what they're already using, or else you find yourself in a lot of meetings with unhappy people.
Right. Yeah. It was a challenge. Definitely. I know that it was a challenge when we were doing that. Overall, I think the results, I was still really happy with the results of Tron. I think it looks fantastic. I think all the hard work that we did during that transition time, because there was a transition time where we transitioned a big portion of the show from Mental Ray to V-Ray and did it in the middle of the show, which was also a no-no. Yeah. But we did it anyway. And I think in the end, the results are great. They were really great. And I think that the people that worked on it and did the hard work and figured out, you know, how we had to do all the translation. There's a lot of translation that had to be done. Huge chunks of pipeline, huge shaders had to be redone. But generally, I think it looked fantastic and you guys did a fantastic job on it. So
yeah. I agree. And, you know, I was thinking about it in the last few days before we spoke, and it was really, you know, the thing that stands out to me most is there was a moment in time where we ran a test. And we had the sort of futuristic bike. I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, the light bikes, yeah.
Light bike?
Yeah.
Riding along that black glass.
Yeah.
And the motion blur, like somebody called out, you know, if your camera is traveling at the same speed of the bike alongside of the bike, then the reflection of the bike in the glass shouldn't be blurred.
Right.
And we could not in any way achieve a result that was tunable and beautiful with Mental Ray. And V-Ray was doing that out of box,
right,
with a speed that we couldn't really match with, you know, this army of people working on rebuilding the shader.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big crux, right? It was that the motion blur, turning on motion blur in Mental Ray was just killed your render times, like physical motion blur, right? And so V-Ray basically had an advantage at that point. And that really was it, was the reflections on the glass.
That was, which that's the whole movie.
That is the whole movie, yeah.
And oddly, I ended up with some contacts at Mental Image and understood already that, you know, 90, like Autodesk, 95%+ of their income comes from industrial and not from media entertainment.
Right.
So the Mental Images had already made a decision years before that they weren't going to pursue modifying Mental Ray to make it work with motion blur.
Right.
You know, Autodesk was selling it to people and saying, you know, it can serve this purpose if you work with it properly. But at a root, it really wasn't intended to be used that way at all. And it was sort of like banging your head against a wall, trying to squeeze that performance out of it, you know?
It's interesting you say that. And it's so interesting if you think about it, like motion blur in itself is actually like a, almost only used by visual effects people.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I always have it on if I'm going to do anything, because I think things look more natural if there's motion anywhere. Right. And so mm-hmm. it's just interesting that it's like, yeah, why would I have that? And it's like, oh, you know, and 2D motion blur doesn't always work. Well, specifically the Tron example is the exact one where 2D motion blur just completely doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, they continued with Mental Ray on, what was the race car? On Speed Racer?
On Speed Racer, yeah, yeah.
And it became a compositing nightmare.
Yeah.
Where they ended up having to completely break apart all of the different layers of the render and then apply 2D motion blur to them and come up with all of these conditions where, you know, if the glass is transparent and reflective and you can see the object behind it, what do you do? And it, you know, I think that type of effort, I think they're, you know, it was smart that they decided to do something that was more brute force yeah. and more guaranteed.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a nightmare for sure. Well, that's interesting. So where were you working before DD?
Well, I was at Cafe FX.
Oh, yeah.
Of all the things that I regret in not having a more formal education, at the point that I decided to go to the U.S. to work, mm-hmm. Not having a degree made it really difficult for me to get a visa.
Right.
So I had been contacted by DD, who I was just in love with the idea of working for, a couple of times, and we would always get to the point that they were ready to sign a contract with me, but not willing to commit the time to hiring somebody who was like mid-level and had the visa requirement that I did.
Right.
So flash forward about a year later, and I had done a little bit of contract work with a few studios in LA, mm-hmm. and my name got passed around. And it was Cafe FX that eventually said, you know what, we have like three rendering problem projects right now that we need to have you sitting in here with us for.
Right. So, was it over in their Santa Monica office or in?
I worked in the Santa Monica office.
Okay. All right. So was Ben Grossman there at the time and those kind of guys?
Well, Ben worked for the Syndicate.
Right. Which was another part of it.
You know, so we kind of passed in the hallway and kind of exchanged little quips about what was happening more
right
at a company level, but we didn't work together. No.
Okay. Because I know, I'm just trying to figure out your connection with Ben, because I know later you end up working for Magnopus for a little bit as well, which we'll get into that, but
yeah.
But it's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So that's cool. Were you working on Pan, or which were some of the projects you worked on at Cafe FX?
When I first got there, they were on Pan's Labyrinth.
Right.
And I think that they did The Mist from Stephen King after that.
Okay.
And in fact, I think that it was The Mist that I joined at the tail end of.
Right.
They did some outsource work for G.I. Joe and then joined the Sony Alice project.
Oh, Alice in Wonderland. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Which I think sunk the company, really.
Was the last one, I think. That was the end of the company, unfortunately, after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a challenge. I think Eric Sheely was probably, I think Eric Sheely was working on Alice over there. It was a lighter. I don't know if you remember him or not. But yeah, that's interesting. That was interesting. So I know, okay, so you're at DD, you're on Tron. I don't remember if you stick around for like Jack the Giant Killer or stuff like that?
No, I you know, the roster of films that were in the, I really wanted to work with David Fincher.
Oh, right.
I had a real love for his work since I started, in school. You know, Seven and The Game had come out shortly before I started school.
Right.
And they were like, you know, they were the pinnacle of what I wanted to work on. So, you know, I think that the Benjamin Button project was just finishing when I got there. Yep. And, you know, I got to sit in on dailies a couple of times, which was fun. And then he took his next project, The Social Network, to a film production studio in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And the only other thing that Didi had going was that Battle Robots, but Something Steel.
Oh, Real Steel, yeah.
Real Steel, yeah. And it was, you know, I wasn't much interested in continuing as part of the lighting team there.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, Fincher. Okay, I want to ask you something. Just like a little detour. I mean, you've had some good. What are your thoughts on Fincher in terms of what he's doing today? Because I think as a director, he's taking an initiative to be very proactive about prioritizing the way he's doing things for streaming, and really sort of taking streaming as a very serious platform for filmmaking. And I saw Mank recently, and I was like, this is it's a really good film, and technically really interesting, all the things he achieves. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I couldn't guess if he was targeting streaming. I think that, I saw some things in the Mank, like, you know, rather than fading to black, they actually kept fading to different levels I want to say gamma, but exposure, where like the brightest light sources in the scene would kind of hang before it completely became black. And it seemed very like HDR friendly. And it had a lot of, my understanding anyways, is that he used a lot of LED panels as projection surfaces to do the VFX, you know. He actually interned at ILM at one point. He's got a reputation for being like a really, really technical director with a deep understanding of the science of what it is that's happening on our teams.
Yeah, you know? And he's very, very good. I mean, I worked with him on Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. And he knows his stuff, you know. He knows color really well. He knows cameras really well. I think they actually used a special edition of the Red camera that only shoots black and white. So they don't have any color sensors on it. It's a black and white sensor, for Mank, which I thought was very, very interesting. I just think it's interesting that, you know, some of the technology and some of the way people are thinking about filmmaking is changing a little bit now. Obviously, streaming has become a bigger priority in terms of releasing films. And I think Fincher has got some really good ideas out there. Obviously, he just signed a 3-year contract with Netflix. So I think, or a big deal, a big contract with Netflix. And it's kind of interesting what he's doing. So it's interesting you were talking about Fincher as well. Well, cool. Okay, so after you left DDE, and then where did you end up going after that?
I spent a little bit of time at the mill.
Oh,
you know,
right.
One of the head of technology there, or the CTO, I can't remember what his title was, mm-hmm. actually contacted me in December of the time that I was at DD.
So and this is the mill in LA?
The mill LA.
Yeah.
And they said, like, you know, we haven't really been in a position to hire TDs and developers outside of London up until recently, and we're scaling up our operation in Santa Monica. Do you want to come and join us and help with some of the problems that are related to, you know, having offices in multiple shores?
Right.
So they had New York and Los Angeles and London at the time. And most of their pipeline was done through some really kind of hard and basic scripts, you know, like rsync copies from one location to another.
Right.
So we started working on building kind of something similar to Atomic, which was like a sort of render outputs to gather elements from the scene graph and then package them up as dependencies so that they could get sent for processing or rendering or simulating whatever it was.
Yeah, we should probably explain what Atomic is, because that's a very DDD thing. Atomic was basically a render layer manager of some kind that was pretty, actually, I really liked Atomic. It became something pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, I think like a lot of things, it was born out of ESC.
Oh, and, right.
You know, like a lot of the concepts that went into it came out of that team of like Rito and John Litt.
Yeah.
We worked so closely together. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the more impressive things that I've seen, like from a code side. You know, there's a lot of really hacky ways to get data in and out of Maya. And this was just like readable and extensible and beautifully written. So,
and I think that it was Blake Sweeney who kind of created a sort of like your own very simple scripting language that you could just write down what you wanted. Like, I want a layer that does this. And then what was amazing in Maya, basically, it would build all the layers for you. Like, you just hit a script and it built it. It's like, I want this. And then like, it would build all those scripts for you. It was quite robust and really quite nice. So, and you know, obviously it's grown even better and more since then, but it was quite good. So anyway, sorry to go back to to your time at the mill. So that was something that you were working on at that time too, right?
Yeah. And, you know, they were interested in, they gave us a pretty broad brush for R&D projects, and we ended up getting a hold of the first Maya to Arnold pipeline. Okay. You know, they had the first Maya to Arnold exporter was open source.
Yes, the M2A one, right? That was
M2A. Yeah. And so I worked with their team to migrate their existing shading pipeline over to Arnold, and in the process, got offered a job at Sony doing similar. So I stayed with the mill for a few months, mm-hmm. and then got brought into the Sony Pictures shader writing team to do a C shader to OSL conversion that they wanted to run.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a lot. It's such an odd time. You know, when I really enjoyed working with Stephen Parker. And at one point we were out for lunch and I was talking about, you know, pipelines and as often you do. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of in a really stoic, like sure way said, Sony did it right. Like the way that Sony handles their product resolution and their asset management is the way that everybody else should have done it. And so I kind of started looking immediately for opportunities within Sony Pictures Imageworks, mm-hmm. because I wanted to see it firsthand and to see, you know, to sort of consume it as a piece of information, because at that point I'd probably touched most people's pipelines in a small way.
Right.
Yeah. I worked for a moving picture company in 2005.
Okay.
In London, and we wrote one of the first sort of dependency packaging APIs that would, you know, pull assets out of Maya and figure out which, you know, which compositing layer had which objects belonging to it. And the sort of time from 2005 up to 2012 working for Spy, I saw a lot of different ways that people were trying to solve the same problem. You know, Temerity and Shotgun and a lot of these asset management tools were variations of the same job.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. So, but what were you working on what were you working on when you were at Imageworks?
Switching the C physical shading library over to OSL.
Yeah, I know that, but was there any particular show that you were working on or was it, you were just overall pipeline, I guess.
Yeah. I think I sat in on Spider-Man and helped debug some, you know, broken shading graphs that were causing problems. Some of the work that I was responsible for was building support for OSL into Katana so that, you know, some of the ways that the workflows that artists had to like branch a shader and create subgraphs, that that was functioning in OSL the way that it already had with their previous shaders.
Right.
And so a lot of that meant going and sitting with people and helping them debug. But the shading group itself was pretty siloed, and ImageWorks worked that way.
Right. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Cause my time at ImageWorks was, I was the last show to ever use burps.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was not a fan of burps. It was my last Render Man show too. And I basically said, I will never render a shadow map ever again in my life is basically what I promised myself at that point. But I know that, you know, that was the first big transition. That was during that time, it was when, and I was actually working with, Marcos was working in the, you know, at the same time at Sony. And they were first bringing in Arnold to work on Monster House. And so it was, you know what? And that was just like you were talking about earlier about, you know, the first transition at DD on a big show to use V-Ray. They were struggling with that in terms of Monster House as well. So, but it was really interesting. And I think obviously all those things have changed. And Marcos has actually been on this podcast before. So that was also,
oh, cool.
Yeah. It was really interesting. Okay. So how long were you at Sony for?
I worked with Sony for almost a year and a half.
Okay.
Part of my contract included moving back to Vancouver. And I think I'd been in LA for about 6 years at that point, maybe seven.
Right.
And I wasn't completely, opposed to the idea at the time. So it was, I think it felt like it was time to go home. And I worked with Sony for a little bit in their Vancouver office, but to be honest, it was a pretty unhappy time in VFX. Mm. Like a lot of people had been asked to move and not really explained to the greater benefit of why that would happen. Yep. And within the team that I was working for and then very nearby, there was a lot of like frequent conversation about people feeling hard done by and upset and, you know, challenging things that were arbitrary, but because they were angry about other things that were going on. So, you know, I worked in the Vancouver office for all of about 6 months.
Okay.
And then a good friend of mine, who I had worked with previously in Vancouver, offered to have me come in and work on his cinematics team. And I was happy to have an opportunity to pivot a little bit away from visual effects. And that actually turned out to be really advantageous.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Well, what was it? What was the cinematic thing you were doing?
Well, so the studio is called Goldtooth, and again, it was another guy who had come out of ESC Entertainment. Uh-huh. And was connected sort of loosely to me for all of these other people I had met along the way. And we did the Arkham Origins trailers, mm-hmm. Some of that, some of the stuff that we did, some stuff for Crysis, CryEngine. I think that was called the Sharp Dressed Man trailer, and some of it was high enough quality that it actually went to television as commercials. And the companies were generally impressed. We turned their shading pipeline around and made it physical, and then streamlined a lot of what they were doing at the time was taking whole scenes out of the game engine and then rendering, converting them to high quality assets and then building new scenes out of them from scratch. Mm-hmm. And then placing their cameras and deciding where to render.
Right.
And we kind of just said why don't we adopt a stronger storyboard and diagramming process?
Right.
And we'll rebuild what's directly in front of the camera. And as much stuff as we don't need to animate, we will paint it using ZBrush and leave it facing the camera in a high quality with no back. So we took this kind of 2.5D approach to rendering that cut down the amount of team that we needed a lot.
Interesting.
And then sort of tried to build a pipeline that would allow us to do as much in-game rendering as possible. Because the more that the game studios were able to advertise that their cinematics were in camera, the more that they could advertise that this is what the experience in the game would be like.
Right. You know?
So fortunately, you know, CryEngine had a 32-bit frame buffer and it was floating point. Mm-hmm. So we could actually marshal data into it and back out directly into Nuke. And we had a kind of, we had a compositing pipeline that was using their engine as a renderer pretty quick.
Interesting.
In the case of Unity, and I think it was the Warner Brothers had a custom cut of Unreal. Both of those were a little bit more difficult to get 30 frame a second animated frames out of, you know, and they had 8-bit buffers. So there was lots of consideration about how to take our high quality 3D scenes and then convert them so that they would run in engine. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So was that your first foray into real-time rendering?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was probably 2015.
Okay. Cause it wasn't that long after that, that I think I ran into you at SIGGRAPH, and I was with Stephen Parker actually at the time. And you were showing me like, I've got this thing. And you were showing me, you were showing me the Leia thing. And I was like, wait, what, what's going on here? I was mind blown.
I was able when I returned to Canada to work as a freelancer, which wasn't something that was possible for me while I was in the US.
Of course, right.
And while I was at Goldtooth, HP Diker reached out to me from within Autodesk and said, hey, we've got these challenges, one of which includes converting the Hypergraph to OSL. Are you interested in doing some freelance work with us?
Right.
And so I was trying to scale up freelance work and looking all over the place for sort of 3D based rendering contracts, and came upon this studio in, or not the studio is wrong, a startup in the Silicon Valley that had a 3D display, which is essentially like a multi-view stereo display.
Right.
And, we had a couple of conversations and it turned out that, you know, they owned the patents on the back-end technology, and they were vetted strongly by a lot of investors and came out of the HP labs in Palo Alto. So it was, you know, it was a piece of technology that had been born at HP, but HP had, for one reason or another, decided not to invest in. And so the owner of Leia, a guy named David Fatale, who was responsible for writing patents at HP at the time, wrote a patent on the work, presented it to HP and said, if you're not interested in this, I'd like to know what would be involved in me extracting this and starting my own company around it.
Right.
You know? So I joined them in July of 2015. No. 2015. No, I guess like the first time I touched real time would have been 2014.
Okay.
I hadn't been using Unity for that long.
Okay.
To be honest. And they wanted a tool that was first going to be a 3D graph editor in Node.js that was kind of like Pastebin, where, you know, you would log into this sort of Pastebin account and it would allow you to connect your display over USB and then build scenes inside of a web browser and then hit play and they would stream out to the device and the device would sort of act as like an external and playback for you, you know?
Right.
And I sat down to working on that with them for a couple of days and they got all hot and bothered about the Unity plugin needing to be handled sooner because they had customers in automotive that wanted it right away.
Right.
So, yeah. So we rolled a plugin and I actually reached out to Ben, who I bumped into at SIGGRAPH, and I shipped that plugin to them, and I had Magnopus creating content for the device about 3 months after I got there.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, it's interesting you say that. So I remember how that happened. You were showing me the display, and just so people understand what we're talking about, you had it on the size of a phone. It was like about a phone display that was about the size of it, and it was basically a 3D display that didn't require glasses. And it was really good. I think that the term Leia comes from, you know, Princess Leia as the little hologram that appears in Star Wars. That was sort of the inspiration behind it. But I remember you showing that to me. I was like, that's really interesting. And then I was hanging out at Magnopus because I like to hang out there every now and then because it's a cool office. Mm-hmm. And I sat next to Sally, and she says, I'm looking at this cool new thing. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've seen that before. And so Sally was working with you guys on doing that. So it was pretty, pretty interesting.
Yeah. I was really lucky to have her as a partner on that side.
Yeah.
You know, she solved on her own some problems with creating content that we hadn't really come up with solutions for internally yet, you know?
Right.
And, the display was touch compatible, and it was actually she and I together that sort of figured out how to read touch inputs across the multi-view, because, you know, the location of your finger is not necessarily the location in frame.
Oh, right.
And they had some weird, you know, they had some weird tricks in order to get the frame on screen that included doing some rotations of the image so that when you first would touch it, it was like Nightcrawler, you know, your finger would just teleport all over the screen. And it was like every project that we worked on had like a 2-week deadline, you know,
yep.
Where it was just like, well, it's Lexus and they want to see something a week from now. And you're like, you know, well, what exactly do they want to see? Oh, they want to see what this would look like if you had a fully 3D avatar in it sitting inside of a car. And it's like, whoa. Okay. Yeah. You know, they know, you know, working within VFX, there's at least some cognizance of the ask that you're being given. And these guys were like exceptionally smart and really hardworking and did not understand the massive teams that it took in order to generate high quality film projects,
right.
You know? So, there was a lot of asset store purchases and a lot of hacking of scripts and, you know, trying to get things running at the same time as trying to make them look beautiful, which was turned out to be really fun, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I thought it was a really interesting project, and it was really cool that you were doing that. And it was, yeah, pretty interesting. You ended up going to work at Magnopus for a little bit, didn't you?
I did. You know, when Leia hit their Series B funding,
yeah.
We had a couple of discussions about, you know, what avenues were opening up within the company. And I was probably a little bored at the time of, you know, pushing on content that I didn't really get to see the whole way through. And I talked to the guys at Magnopus, and we sort of describe some of the problems that they were having with projects that were in the works. And a couple of months later, I joined them.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And you moved back to LA at that point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I took, you know, I did the 40-year-old thing, and I went to India for a little while. And then I took like 3 months and drove around in a car and slept on my friends' couches and like surfed and ate bad food. And it was, you know, it was fun.
That's cool. But I know you probably can't talk too much. I mean, it's very rarely that you get to talk about actual projects that come out of Magnopus, but is there anything you can tell us of what you were working on over there?
Well, you know, I worked on the 3 Magic Leap projects that came out in October of 2018.
Okay.
2018. And those were, Ben led them. And they were working with John Gaeta to make some content. He was like a creative
yep.
executive at Magically, and they had some kind of keynote presentations of work that they wanted to do. And I worked with them kind of with the intention of defining where they had problems in their pipeline, because they had a much larger project that they were planning, and they wanted to sort of use, they wanted to figure out what would be the challenges in doing such a huge project, you know?
Right.
The second project was like a walk, you know, like a theme park size walk through AR experience. And it was going to be very story driven and required like a MMO backend in order to like feed people location information and to update the content in front of them.
Okay.
So, you know, the problems that they had were the same problems that you would have in a boutique that was doing like commercials and decided that they wanted to do a feature animation like the next week.
You know? Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was that. Yeah, that sounds like a massive project for sure, for sure. Yeah. But you really, I guess, you really got into AR at that point. I mean, with Leia and with your Match Leap stuff, AR became something of sort of an important part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly like the challenge of finding new stuff to work on, and you know, there's a lot of work that has yet to be spoken for in figuring out all of the different ways that we made content look beautiful in film and how to realize those same things technically on a mobile handheld device, you know?
Right.
I mean, ultimately, Leia's product is an Android product, and the Magic Leap is an Android product, and the Oculus Quest is an Android operating system with some custom gear built on top of it.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, the challenge is how many milliseconds do I have to run any one part of this code or to use that code to create pixels? And it's kind of fun working against the clock like that. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you don't have that much compute power, and you have to have very low latency and a lot of frame rates. So it's kind of like counterintuitive in a lot of ways.
Well, it probably feels like the way that our work did in like 2005 and 2006,
right?
You know, where it's like, as you start heading towards the end of a project, you start to lose sight of what the cost of your technology is versus the cost of choices that you've made to do texturing, lighting, shading, and you start to have to throw things off of the boat in order to make it the whole way,
right?
You know, and without like a real clear view of budgeting for each of those different disciplines, or, you know, you really are always going to find yourself in a position where, you know, the goal in mobile rendering is to use as much of the resources you can and not more.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the answer is make it look better.
Yep.
And if there's more bandwidth, then you need to consume that bandwidth. And, you know, so you're kind of always jockeying that line where you're trying to beat the clock, which is, you know, it keeps the game a little bit fresh.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, I think it's interesting you say, you know, especially when it comes to real time, right? So now, you know, you've kind of nailed it when you say, you know, when we were doing back in 2000, you know, 3, 4, 5, you know, when people weren't using ray tracing, right? And so it was much more of a rasterized a thing back then, and trying to get, it was always a battle of, you know, can I raise the quality and still get my render time to be under 2 hours, right? Or whatever it is, or do I have enough RAM? Or even back then, you know, especially a lot of the machines, you know, if you're on a Windows machine, you only had 32-bit operating systems and only can hold 2 gigs of memory on a computer, which sounds insane these days. So, you know, those are challenges we met. And it's interesting now that we're back now and we're doing that, and we're looking at this as a, you know, we want to do something at 60 or 90 Hertz or 120 Hertz. we're back to those days when it was like, okay, we can cut this out. We don't need that in memory, like whatever it is.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, are you still very much interested in real time at this point?
Yeah, in fact, maybe September, I did some prototype work for a company here in Vancouver that had like a WebGL product, and I I bumped into, you know, they asked for something that was like highly reflective and physically based, but at the same time would be built dynamically using web-based assets. You know, they had this huge database of like sports paraphernalia data that they wanted to be able to assemble into these shareable tokens for a mobile phone app.
Okay. You know?
Users would sort of lay their bets or do their gameplay, and then they would get a copy. They would get these sort of objects that were half sports highlight video and half sort of custom LA Lakers swag or something like that.
Okay.
You know? The visual target was pretty high quality. Hmm. And when I stepped out into looking at what the state of the art was, I found an engine called Babylon and Babylon.js. And they have full photorealistic rendering in browser using nothing but HTML5. And it accesses the GPU with the same slickness as using an embedded app like Unity would on a mobile phone.
Interesting.
So the last couple of months, I've been kind of working a lot of my 3D video content into interactive 3D scenes that are based on that Babylon engine, kind of with the intention of helping companies scale up around using 3D data in a browser. You know, the latest version of Firefox has a send tab to XR device button built into it.
Okay.
So there's sort of this vision of the future that maybe I'm not alone in, where people would be sitting like I am now and pop on something like an Oculus Quest and use a single button to send a VR or AR experience to that device.
Okay.
Yeah. I think in the augmented reality world, I think it's Qualcomm has a chip that's coming out. Anyway, there's an initiative on 5K to build proprietary augmented reality glasses that will stream content directly from your phone.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So sort of similarly, you'd be walking down the street and get an email message from somebody that says, I want you to take a look at the latest version of something or other that I've built for you. And you could pull the glasses out of your pocket, pop them on, and then view them in a 3D context.
Right.
Using kind of like Quest, using hand gestures instead of input control.
Yeah. You know, I see some very interesting AR use cases all the time. And like one of the ones that makes the most sense, and this is in an architecture point of view, is specifically using, because when they build a hospital, right? Like a hospital is a great example. A hospital has tons and tons and tons of mechanical stuff, right? You got oxygen lines going through there. You got air ducts. You got air filtration. You got a lot of, you know, water and different things flowing through the building. And all that stuff needs maintenance. And it's kind of a complicated thing to figure out all the maintenance and where to go, et cetera, et cetera. But what they did is, because the whole building is built in 3D now, when they build it using Revit, they actually created augmented reality applications where you just put, you know, your augmented reality HoloLens or whatever you're doing, and you put it on and you walk around the building and it says, oh, stop here, that right there, that needs maintenance.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, that's awesome. As opposed to you like, I don't know, where do I go? You know, it's like, no, it'll tell you where to go.
Well, and I think, you know, going back to what we were speaking about earlier, I think the industrial use case is orders of magnitude more important than media entertainment.
Yes.
And I think that HoloLens or Microsoft really hit the nail on the head with the audience that they're targeting with HoloLens too. You know,
right.
I was reading just today that there's something like an 82% improvement in performance on people who are looking at a heads-up view of an instruction manual versus people who are flipping through pages in a book.
Right.
You know, and that, you know, that was something that probably in the days of Leia we started to discuss. You know, automotive is a better choice for us than video games, and you know, what are some other cases? Like education is a huge one. You know? Mm-hmm. if you could get somebody to interact with an experience by touching the screen three times, there's a 700% increase in retention of information.
Interesting.
So putting somebody down in front of an experience, which is sort of the angle that I was thinking when I decided to make a portfolio site, is like, if you can get someone to reach out and touch it and see it and touch it two more times, then they will walk away speaking to themselves mentally about what it is that they've just done. Mm. And that's impactful in a way that, you know, like a flip book or a contact sheet really can't be. You know?
Right. So. Yeah. Really interesting. Really interesting. Okay. So let's catch up a little bit to where we are today. So you're back in Vancouver at this point, and you said you're looking to go back to Europe, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky in that the work that I'm being offered at this point is mostly remote. Mm-hmm. I think that for the way that I'm enjoying spending my time these days, I think that I'm going to continue to work remotely. And so I've been looking at contracts in and around the EU that would be related to things like autonomous vehicles or computer vision, and maybe, you know, there's a lot of work kind of in sort of general 3D pipelines and 3D rendering that's related to creating synthetic data for computer vision testing. And so I've been talking to a number of people out that way about projects that they have and sort of narrowing the scope of people whose doors I want to knock on when I get there.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I've seen a lot of use cases where people are using high-end CG work to create use cases to train computer vision AI.
Yeah. Well, I mean, fundamental to machine learning is domain adaptation. Mm-hmm. And that just means adding a little bit of noise to your sample so that you can train your algorithm to see the same thing without having to go out and get an entirely new data set, you know? Right. And using 3D, you can actually read the performance of your algorithm against the data that it's looking at and identify specific cases where your system is having trouble, you know, finding or isolating pieces within the frame, you know, segmenting.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, you basically have ultimate control of your 3D environment if it's all in CG, right?
Right. I mean, you can put a tree in front of a stop sign a million different ways using, like, pretty off-the-shelf tools in an application like Houdini, right, which speaks directly to Unreal. So,
you know, that's okay. That's a great, I mean, I just realized what you just said when you said that. It's like, oh, right. Because if I'm doing a computer vision program and I'm teaching an autonomous car to see the road, there's going to be lots of cases where a tree is in front of a stop sign and it has to be able to recognize that stop sign behind the tree. We know it because we're human, but the computer does not. So we have to train it to understand that there's a stop sign behind there.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch, there's a, Google did a talk on their autonomous stuff recently.
Okay.
One of them was Tesla. The guy who runs the AI department in Tesla is one of the most interesting people whose name I can't repeat right now, that I've listened to in the last long time. Hmm. He speaks incredibly quickly and he's so information rich. It's astounding.
Right.
But he did a presentation and he was talking about the variations in a stop sign. And there was 40-something different cases, you know?
Right.
Sometimes a stop sign is attached to the back of a school bus and the school bus is parked. Or sometimes it's attached to the back of a school bus and the school bus is moving.
Right.
And sometimes it's attached to a draw arm in a parking lot.
Yep.
And sometimes it's attached to a draw arm and it's completely faded and somebody spray painted on top of it. So there's like, you know, if you think about how easier would be to generate the subset of those variations using 3D software versus going out and searching for locations where those things had happened. It's a pretty clear case.
Yeah, I remember actually seeing a video that went out about this garage that had a sign that looked like a stop sign that poked out of the garage, and these Teslas were just like stopping in front of this garage every time. But yeah, okay. So actually, you know, what are your thoughts about computer vision and that area? Because I know, you know, very famously, Tesla made this point that they said they don't feel that LiDAR is necessary when it comes to autonomous driving, where everyone else is using LiDAR to try to do things. And they think that basically, if you have a very robust computer vision system through AI, that, you know, the car can see just like any other person sees. It doesn't need a LiDAR to be able to do that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, in my understanding, you know, in the same video that I was talking about a second ago, he describes them taking their, they're not using LiDAR because using LiDAR would create a massive data set that they don't want to be responsible for maintaining. And it also would require them to support more than one camera format.
Right. You know?
Whereas with like the 9 or 15, whatever cameras that they have around the vehicle, they can actually stitch them all together into a single three-dimensional view and then use stereo reprojection to figure out the distance that any one of those pixels is from the camera that took the picture.
Right.
So you're kind of getting the benefit of LiDAR from a data set that doesn't require you to maintain it. You know,
right.
When the car itself is making decisions, they're stitching the 3D view and then converting it into a bird's eye view. And then they're making decisions about right and left turns in a completely two-dimensional plane. So, you know, it's like what you want in small hardware, and that is to collapse down the instructions as many times as you can so that you're getting the most for the least amount of compute, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And I agree, but mostly because of how much I admire what I've seen them accomplish. You know, if I owned LiDAR, I might have a different opinion on it.
Right.
But
yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that definitely, you know, there's a whole, you know, very, very interesting world of computer vision and training and all of that. And it's really interesting that you've gotten involved in that at this point. Do you feel like at this point you're not as interested to going back to visual effects or to the entertainment industry? Does this new path seem much more viable and interesting to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when I first started looking outside of visual effects, it was because it's benefited my career to continue to have new things to learn, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't really sit well with the idea that what I'm being asked to do tomorrow, somebody else might be able to do just as well as me and be sitting next to me, you know? So as much as possible, going out and consuming new information means going out and understanding how to solve new problems. And I think that, you know, there's always a concern that you've swam too far away from the shore and you're neither the, you know, you're not a TD anymore and you're not a shader writer and you're kind of stuck with half of a skill set in two different places. And, you know, half of a skill set doesn't really get you very, very far in either of those two places. So, I feel like I'm far enough out there at this point that I can continue to find work in these industries. And I actually in recent months been working as an advisor for some small startup companies who have a 3D backend that they need domain expertise on. So,
right.
For sure.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, obviously, I did, you know, a similar thing. I've moved away from visual effects, and I don't know how easy it would be for me to go back into production. I don't, and you know, I left it for many reasons, you know, including the one that you mentioned before. I wasn't necessarily willing to move to Vancouver, even though I love the city. It's just, you know, my wife had a job here, and I just wasn't going to tell her to quit her job so that we, because that's what I was told I have to do. That was one of them. The other one is also just, you know, shot production is grueling, you know, and sometimes it's just like, I needed something different, and I was inspired, you know, by what the Chaos Group is doing. And they do touch a lot of different markets. And it's really interesting, but I thought it was really interesting when I met you at SIGGRAPH, and you showed me, it's like, I'm doing something completely different now. And then it was like, that is really interesting. And I think the use cases are really interesting as well. So really cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, we saw at the point that I left them, the content that we had worked on together, Ben and I and Sally, it was what got them the contract with Red Camera and won them an award at the Display Week.
Yeah.
And you know, they took a significant boost, and it set the Series B funding in motion. So, you know, that was a huge benefit to the company, and it also created an opportunity for me to step out of the picture without disaffecting existing work.
Right.
So, you know, it was fun, you know, and the challenges within a startup are maybe as many as you would find in a VFX production, but there's something to be said for having ownership of the thing that you're creating, and having a need to spend the money that you're getting and not to save it, you know?
Right.
I mean, startups sell themselves to investors by how much resources that they can consume, because, you know, if they consume all the money that they gave you and came up with something, then they need more.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah.
Working against a budget is quite a grueling and difficult thing. And I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Even in the case of Magnopus, I was quite lucky in them entertaining me as a research and development and sort of back-end programmer. And it kept me away from some of the pace of doing shot work.
Yeah. 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 For sure. For sure. Well, cool. Well, listen, Robert, it's been really cool. You know, we're over an hour, but which is fine. But I really appreciate you coming on. I don't know if you remember, but Kristen will tell you that you, after we say our goodbyes, just hang on for a little bit, because we'll need to upload the rest of the video file. But it's been awesome talking to you, man. Every time we chat, you always have some very interesting things and points of view about how things are going. And I really like what you're saying about computer vision. And that's a very fun and creative and thought provoking problem to solve. You know, computer vision is really interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. And it was cool to catch up as well. If you get a chance, you should look at the Babylon JS.
It's
quite interesting. And, you know, probably the next generation of it, which will be WebGPU and not WebGL, it's going to have the compute shading that we relied on to do a lot of the really high-end work at Magnopus.
Interesting.
So it will be pretty exciting what it will be possible to do in a browser quite shortly.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think there's obviously, you know, there's a lot of new, like you said, there's also a lot of new hardware out there that's going to make things very interesting as well. You know, obviously, you know, we've heard all about the M1 chip from Apple is very interesting. I mean, I've also, you know, on the other spectrum, I've got a 64 core, a single CPU socket on my computer these days, which is insane. So I think that, you know, hardware is going to be able to deal with quite a bit of stuff these days. So I think it's going to be really interesting what happens in the next few years and how people are going to take advantage of that.
NVIDIA starts actually handing out cards again, we'll all have RTX to play with at home.
Yep. Unfortunately, we partner with NVIDIA, so they do give me some hardware sooner than people get these days. So
nice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more fortunate, but we do a lot of great work with them, and they're very much a supporter of our GPU render. So they want to make sure that we have the hardware that we can test all this stuff on. So we make sure that happens, so that by the time you do get your GPU, you know that V-Ray GPU will work as well as it can on it. Well, cool. All right. Thanks a lot, Robert. I appreciate it.
Cheers, man. And have a good week.